Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. My partner, Matt Ryan, is off this week. Well, the budget is over, Easter is past. This time of year is usually pretty quiet around the state capitol, but it hasn't been. And here to discuss reasons why, I am happy to be joined at the Reporters Roundtable by two of the best, Bill Mahoney from Politico New York and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. All right. Governor Andrew Cuomo was in Albany last Saturday, the day before Easter, for an open house at the Executive Mansion. Children got Easter eggs, if they found them, and reporters got a Q&A where the governor said, you know what, the legislative session is pretty much over. Not in so many words, but that was clearly his message. There's no will to do ethics reform. All of the policy matters that were outstanding, at least in terms of the governor's mind, were settled in the state budget.
That's right.
How are these people going to stay busy for the next 2 months?
That's right. According to the governor, it should be a quiet time in news, which it never is. Yeah, that's a good question. Are they just going to come in and collect their per diems and not do anything? I think that when the legislature comes back starting Monday, I think they're going to have a different opinion about whether things are over or not, because they still have things that they want to accomplish. The big omission in the budget was the ethics reform, and the governor now says that they don't have the will to do it, and it sort of differs from what he said a month ago about ethics. And I'm quoting now your story, Bill, that you had about that he said two different things about ethics, right?
It was, yeah, originally before the budget, he said, oh, I think this was specifically in terms of things like early voting and some of the election reforms that came up during last year's presidential election.
That's right.
But he said in March, these will all be post-budget issues. We're going to try like heck.
That's right.
And then come a week after the budget, it became, well, there's no will, so that's not going to happen. And it didn't sound quite like trying like heck.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Granted, the budget process was much more acrimonious and tense than we have seen in past years. It dragged on well past the deadline. And I imagine that, to be fair, Cuomo probably is feeling a little bit deflated about his ability to negotiate with the legislature and get them to fold on things in exchange for other things, because we saw how difficult that was. And there's nothing that needs to happen at the end of session, so he has less ability to force these big things in.
Yeah. Of course, the elephant in the room here is 9 former associates of Governor Cuomo, been in federal indictment on corruption charges. Their trials are starting later this year. So maybe he doesn't want to call attention to this issue. He's probably not going to get it through the Senate Assembly anyway, so why keep reminding people, oh yeah, 9 of my former associates, including my former closest aide, are under indictment right now.
And that is one area where the legislature could push for action. Like, one of the holdups in things like ethics is often the Assembly Democrats and Senate Republicans have different ideas of what reform entails.
Yes, absolutely.
But on the area of reforms that have to do with the arrest of Cuomo's associates, which are largely procurement reforms, there seems to be agreement between those two conferences that increasing the power of Comptroller DiNapoli to investigate the executive branch is the way to go.
Controller DiNapoli is also in agreement with him on that.
He has a bill that's sponsored by pretty powerful members of both of the majority conferences. Now, Cuomo's idea is that he should be able to appoint more inspector generals and basically have more power himself.
Who would be answerable to him.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that hasn't seemed to fly with the legislature, but it's possible the legislature, the two majority conferences at least, can try to push something through on procurement reform.
Yeah. Are they going to take the initiative or not? That's a big question.
Go ahead.
They will have plenty of other things to deal with, too. Like, we've probably got 500 more bills that need to pass this year, and most of these are the things that you're probably not going to discuss on your show, like renaming a bridge after a state trooper or something like that.
Extending lodging taxes and that kind of thing that just need to get passed every periodically. Mm-hmm.
And that often have these lengthy debates for no seeming reason that take up days and days, right?
And there will be some items that I'm sure they'll come to an agreement on and really try to sell as major accomplishments, like the child marriage issue, for example. That was not a part of the budget.
Bizarrely,
it's recently been discussed that, you know, you're allowed to marry with up as low as 14 in New York. And it seems like the younger end of that, people who are 14 and 15, that happens pretty rarely, a few times a year, but pretty much nobody's in favor of the idea of a 14-year-old being allowed to marry.
Cannot wait for the Kumbaya press conference at the end of the legislative session where they try to bill reforming child marriage laws as kind of a big win.
One thing that I wanted to men- contention is that, you know, we may very well see another special session after the federal budget passes in October if there's big cuts to New York through President Trump and the Republican-led Congress. I mean, so far they haven't been able to get together to repeal Obamacare or do major tax reform, but I think in the budget we can be pretty sure that they're going to cut big liberal states like New York and California, and they're going to have to come back to deal with that.
Well, and here's something else interesting that I noticed. I believe it was this week, the state commission that's in charge of judicial nominations to the Court of Appeals officially began the process of filling the seat vacated by the death of Sheila Abdesalam. Mm-hmm. The clock there, the timeline for filling that position will require the Senate almost certainly to come back in the fall. In other words, they have a certain amount of time to collect applications, to vet them, to recommend to the governor. The governor then has time to look at them and pick from the list. So the Senate, at least, will likely, if they go according to statute, come back in the fall to have to deal with that. Who knows what else they might want to take up.
The year is far from over.
Yes, indeed.
Far from over.
One development this week in the absence of lawmakers in Albany is the governor named his chief of staff, Melissa DeRosa, to become secretary. She is the first woman to serve in that post. Melissa DeRosa is somebody who we have all dealt with for years and years, working for various politicians and in various roles. But her appointment has proven to be controversial in a variety of quarters, and it prompted an especially ugly war of words, especially on social media.
Yeah, well, first of all, we should say her father is a lobbyist. He represents the big 1199 union, which fought for the $15 minimum wage. Her husband is an executive with Uber, which was a big part of the budget. So there's all kinds of questions about, is this a conflict of interest?
Matt Wing, her husband, is another former top Cuomo aide.
And is she getting more flack because she's a woman or not? Governor Cuomo says she is. And you got to think, why is the pressure on her for the conflict of interest? I mean, I was thinking this morning, maybe her father or her husband could, like, recuse themselves. So there is more pressure on her for that. But that said, there is potential conflict there because she's going to be involved in everything. And all issues are tied together, as we saw in the big, ugly budget that passed.
We have seen some similar things come up in the past, like Joe Bruno's son, for example, I believe, worked as a lobbyist, and similar issues were raised at that point. But yeah, it does seem to be more intense now, and partially because, as you said, her agenda is basically state government. This is the top, like, executive branch job you can really have. So it's difficult. Like, if you look at her father, he's at the fourth biggest lobby firm in Albany. Like, I think it's 130-something clients. Mm-hmm. There's pretty much no issue that somebody at his firm doesn't work on. And she said, and the governor's office has said, that she recuses herself from things that her family members are directly involved in. But we just don't know how broad that extends, and we'll see. It's going to be a difficult thing, but at the very least, nobody said she isn't qualified, at least in terms of her work experience.
Well, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. She's definitely qualified.
Ed Cox, however, Ed Cox, state Republican chairman on Twitter.
Got to bring up this part.
Called her a, quote, petty thug. That and other things that came from Ed Cox and other quarters prompted a response from Charlie King, who is a longtime Cuomo lobbyist, now works for Mercury Partners, a significant consulting and lobbying firm. And he was Cuomo's 2002 running mate in the governor's ill-fated first gubernatorial run.
I'm waiting to see how Casey's going to explain this on the air.
Okay.
The way Charlie King said
is, in this long statement, Charlie King kind of built up to saying, well, Ed Cox, you know, can be a respectable man, but, and he basically went for Cox and used a bad pun, a really bad pun, that utilized what I think we would all recognize as a homophobic slur.
Yeah,
the next day,
Cox's
I guess later that evening, he apologized and said, well, it's just a sign of how this situation can make good people do terrible things.
Well, Charlie King has become Cuomo's kind of go-to guy to say outrageous things that the governor doesn't want to say. And it is kind of sad that it's, you know, in politics now you have to do the personal attacks whenever anything happens and you have to have this back and forth, but it just seems like that's the part. You have to have your guy who says the outrageous things. You have to do a personal insult on somebody, and we're just seeing it more and more, even with reaction to news stories when the reform groups criticize the governor. I've noticed a couple of stories I've done recently, they will go out of their way to make a personal attack on the person who is, you know, making some kind of point that should be open for public debate.
To be fair, it seemed like Charlie King's message did get out more. Like, he was criticized for this, but more people read his defenses of Melissa DeRosa than some other, like, I believe Christine Quinn made some similar comments in defense of DeRosa the day beforehand, but hers were much more tame, and I don't recall seeing the flood of stories about that we saw with Charlie King's.
Okay, but is that good, though? I mean, really,
I'm not saying it's good for public discourse,
to borrow Nietzsche's term, I think it's beyond good and evil. So moving along, one thing that did change in the budget that reform groups were not happy about is the reporting requirements for the Startup New York program got dropped. So
that's right. Startup's been a headache for Governor Cuomo. They spent $45 million on ads. They only got 400 jobs, according to reports that they're required to make. So they fixed that little problem. Now the companies don't have to report the number of jobs they create. So problem fixed. Let's move on. And that's another problem of having these big, ugly budgets that pass over the weekend, overnight. Nobody reads them. And it took about a week before this came out. I believe our former colleague here, J.T. Mador of Newsday, mm-hmm. was the one who broke that story. He probably was one of the few people to actually read through the budget and find that.
A budget maven.
Yeah, so we got to credit him for that. But who knows what else is in that budget that we don't know about.
And we've seen some reporting snafus with Startup in the past. I think just last year, for example, their reports were written to be due on March 31st, when pretty much everybody in Albany is focused entirely on the budget and not really going through those with a fine-tooth comb. But last year, they just blew through that deadline and wound up releasing them on the Friday before 4th of July weekend at 4:30 p.m.
Yeah,
and
ridiculous.
Once again, not many people were spending their Independence Day reading through
reports
on economic development.
Just us, right?
Speaking of reporting requirements, the governor showed off his tax returns, or his folks showed off his tax returns, and it was revealed that in 2016, the governor made $218,000 as the last installment of the money he received from HarperCollins for his memoir, came out in 2014, All Things Possible.
Which, unfortunately, has not sold very many copies, anywhere from 3,200 to maybe as many as 5,000 copies, which is, about $200 per book he's being paid. So did they make a bad gamble on him, HarperCollins?
Clearly, yes. wasn't even released in paperback, All Things Possible. That's how poorly it sold.
Or is it because HarperCollins is owned by the Murdoch family, right? And so if the governor of New York, who you have interest before, comes to you and says, I'm going to do a book, will you give me some money? Are you going to tell him, well, let's see if it sells first, and then we'll give you money? So that's, is that implicit in the deal?
To be fair, I'm guessing some contracts like this are probably gambles, too. Like, maybe he will run for president and become president in 2020. We could imagine this selling many more copies at that point. And if they have the rights, it could turn out to be profitable. I don't think it's a safe bet at this point that this is going to become
the
next Dreams of My Fathers or anything like that.
They call that backlist. All right, well, that's where we're going to have to end it. So thanks very much to Bill Mahoney from Politico New York and Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. This week's New York Now poll question asks, what policy issues do you want to see tackled before the end of session? You can vote at nynow.org. Well, last week we saw you. We asked, do you like the governor's new free college tuition plan? And the majority said no, about 57% giving thumbs down to that. Some of the responses, including this from Gary in Brockport, watching on WXXI. Anyone who thinks that this won't raise New York's already high taxes is not being realistic. Janet in Winthrop, watching on Mountain Lakes PBS, also voted no. I don't agree with mandating full-time enrollment to be eligible, as this does discriminate against adults holding full-time jobs while they attend college. And finally, Maxine in Schoharie voted yes, saying there are far too many talented students who are being discouraged from college by the rising costs of higher education. Thanks again to all those who took the time to respond. You can do so this week by heading to nynow.org. While you're there, you can watch any of our past programs, plus follow links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is @nynow_PBS. You'll also find a pathway to the Capital Confidential blog. It's also at timesunion.com. The State Olympic Regional Development Authority recently announced a new president. Ted Blazer, who had served for over two decades, retired in February, and that opened the door for North Country native Mike Pratt to take over. After serving as the general manager for Gore Mountain, Pratt takes over an organization that's trying to keep up in the ultra-competitive world of retaining world-class athletes, all the while fighting what's become yearly financial woes. My partner, Matt Ryan, spoke to Pratt earlier this month.
Well, Mike, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on becoming ORTA's new president.
Thank you.
Before we get into questions I have, let's give the audience a little background on yourself before taking this position. You grew up in the North Country, right? Graduate of Potsdam State, and the general manager of Gormown, which you, I guess you technically still are for another few days here.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm a native of Lake Placid, and as you said, I've worked at Gormown for 30 years.
The legislature came to an agreement on a budget a few weeks ago. Before this, a budget extender was passed, and in that extender, $28 million was given to upgrade ORTA facilities. This includes $20 million to enhance the current facilities at Gore and Whiteface Mountains, as well as $8 million in upgrades at Bel Air, which is in the Catskills, to create state-of-the-art skiing, lodging, dining, etc. Can you give a little more specifics about what you plan on doing at these facilities to make them more attractive?
Well, sure. We're very excited with this opportunity. We're modernizing the lodges at Gore and Whiteface. We're installing a base-to-summit gondola at Bel Air, and we're just starting the planning process for some year-round attractions and operations.
Did these facilities really need an upgrade? I haven't skied in a number of years, but were they long overdue?
Absolutely, yeah. The maintenance crews at all the facilities have done a great job keeping things going, but the Upper Mountain Lodge at Gore, for instance, is a 1962 original, and it's long overdue to be modernized.
Whiteface is the most recognized of the three. How has business been at the mountains this year, specifically at Gore and Bel Air?
We've both had solid years, certainly coming off of last year. Right in the beginning of the year, we decided not to compare to last year, so we've been comparing to a three-year average, and what that allowed us to do is compare two record years and last year's horrible winter year. Started off behind because of some soft preseason sales, and caught up and stayed ahead. So it's been a solid year for us.
A good March and April, I'm sure this time around. But yeah, last year was devastating for those with like winter activities. I mean, it was bare for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're still open this year. So this Easter weekend, we'll be open at all three ski resorts.
The Times Union had an article earlier this year that focused on the operating losses for the last decade, around $175 million total, including I think a $25 million hit last year. An audit by the state controller in 2014 said ORTA borrowed money just to meet payroll. How concerned are you about the long-term health? How concerned should people be about the long-term health of the ORTA facilities?
Yeah, well certainly we're focusing on our fiscal management. The Times Union article took the worst line items in the budgets, which were before a lot of appropriations and different line items, I guess minimized those impacts. But the ORTA legislative mandate to provide world-class training. We do operate some facilities that we just can't generate revenue from, such as the bobsled track and ski jumps. So we're struggling with regards to those, but the ski resorts typically carry their own. We do give some bobsled rides and generate some revenue and give tours at the ski jumps. It's a spectacular view at from the top of the ski jump hill. There's a glass elevator. So, again, it's not something that's going to offset the cost of providing world-class athletes with superior facilities.
The ski jump, I mean, that's one of the first things you see. It's just a tremendous view as you come into town. Long-term wise, does it make sense to keep that up? Structurally, and to make sure that's still sound going forward for years and years?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been doing the maintenance. It is sound. We're trying to do some improvements to modernize it and keep the sport healthy, the athletes give them a facility that they can train and be competitive on the world stage. So, I think from our perspective, absolutely.
You're not just competing against other ski resorts, of course, but places like Salt Lake City, the home of the 2002 Olympic Games, Colorado Springs, where they have their own Olympic training facility. Besides the good reputation that the town is based, on its history here, do these other facilities hold their own? We talked earlier that the Luge extended their agreement here.
Yeah, when cities host the Olympics, they typically send a group of delegates to Lake Placid to learn how to operate venues after their Olympics, and we're viewed as one of the real success stories. We are continually trying to modernize, trying to adjust to the demands of the sports and the athletes, and do a real nice job of hosting events. One of the nice things about being in the East with world-class events is typically when they're televised in Europe, they're on prime time, and it's nice exposure for not only for New York State and Lake Placid, but for the whole country.
We're in the downtime here, speaking in mid-April. But the winter season is big for you, right? Not just for ski resorts, but you have some world competitions here, right?
Yeah, we did. We hosted national championships for cross-country skiing this year and world championships for bobsled, freestyle, and mogul competitions.
We talked about how the downtime now, you can see there's no ice on the rink, which is pretty rare. This time of year, what's happening up here?
We're organizing our efforts, doing all our maintenance, making sure that the facilities are ready to operate, and taking advantage of our window of opportunity to do the maintenance on the infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
You succeeded Ted Blazer, who had been here a long time. I think he was only the second ever president of ORTA, right? What's been the learning curve like for you? You're only a little less than a month on the job here now. What have you been kind of keeping up with the last few weeks as you transition to this new job?
Well, I'm certainly juggling a lot of balls. The ski resorts and the venue operations I'm very comfortable with, but there's a lot of stakeholders and learning the national and international sports committees and organizations and their, I guess, desires and needs is something that I'm still learning.
One of the good things for you, I would imagine, is that there's a lot of wealth of knowledge up here. We just, Jim Rogers, who's been up here for a long time, people able to help you out, maybe some of the areas you're still learning about?
No, absolutely. Like the heritage in Lake Placid and the, it's got tremendous natural resources, but it's the people that make it special, and they're certainly sharing their knowledge and experiences with me.
Finally, almost every leader likes to put their stamp on the organization, right, as they come into a role such as president. Have you thought about that at all, a long-term project that you would like to see come to fruition or maybe have come to Lake Placid?
Certainly I'm walking into ideas that have already been started. I'm focusing on trying to make the venues all reliable, taking care of our maintenance and our infrastructure as we're planning on bidding and talking about other potential events. So it's an exciting time. But as far as myself, right now, it's not about me. It's about the organization. It's about the state. It's about Lake Placid and the region and all the venues and employees that work with us.
You talked about the maintenance. I mean, that's really important, isn't it? I mean, you're competing against, like we said, Colorado Springs and Salt Lake City. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to give athletes and organizations a reason not to come here.
Right. No, we've got a tremendous reputation, and we've earned it by working hard over the years, and we have to continue to make sure we're looking at the little things, dotting our I's, crossing our T's in order to be successful in the future.
Finally, last question. We've been in here for about a half hour inside the Herb Brooks Arena where the 1980 Miracle on Ice happened here during the games. People come in, they just saw a woman with her son pointing to center ice. That's where the winning goal was scored. You've got an interesting story to tell. Where were you when the U.S. team beat the Russians 4-3 in 1980?
Well, during the Olympics, I worked right on the ice crew out of this 1980 rink. So I was right behind the glass where the Zamboni comes in and out.
I mean, that would describe what that was like. I mean, that was You probably didn't think the Americans were going to win that night, did you?
Oh, the whole building was just rocking. It was shaking. The story with the Americans getting blown out in Madison Square Garden and then coming to the Olympics and just winning close game after close game. It was remarkable. It was an incredible time. And as a young man, I realized how big it was for the sport of hockey, but I had no idea how big socially it was and never could have fathomed how long it would be remembered and as such an important moment.
And one of your first thoughts as someone who cleans the ice was, I've got a lot of work to do here.
Yeah, it was. I was staying focused. There was a mess to clean up, and we had more events to prepare for.
All right. Well, Mike Pratt, thanks for sitting down with us, and good luck moving forward.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
Well, as noted, my partner Matt Ryan is off this week, but we want to take a moment to note that his hour-long special, Governor Mario Cuomo Poetry and Prose, was honored earlier this month by the New York State Broadcasters Association as 2016's Best Documentary. It's a fascinating look at the late governor's 12 years in office, and I highly recommend checking it out on WMHT.org. Well, we leave you today with video of the Au Sable River as it courses through Keene Valley. For everybody here at WMHT, have a great week.